WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Once a week on our show, we're featuring interviews from our archives. Today, we've selected an interview that a lot of listeners missed because it was preempted on many stations by last week's presidential press conference. As a Catholic and feminist, Nancy Mares knows she set herself up for some spiritual, social, and intellectual dilemmas. She writes about some of them in her new memoir, Ordinary Time. She describes her book as a 20th century version of the spiritual autobiographies undertaken by her Puritan foremothers, aimed at harmonizing the divine, the secular, and the personal. Faith has not relieved her of pain and inner torment. Mares suffers from multiple sclerosis. She's been an agoraphobic and has been suicidally depressed. When she was writing her memoir, her husband was getting chemotherapy treatments for cancer. Ordinary Time is Mares' fourth book. Writer Francine Prose described this new memoir as a small miracle of honesty mediated by dignity and humor. I asked Nancy Mares to begin with a reading from the opening of Ordinary Time.
Hear, Grace. You will love me, my husband asks, and at something in his tone my consciousness rouses like a startled cat, ears pricked, pupils round and onyx black. Never voluble, he has been unusually subdued this evening. Thinking him depressed about the mysterious symptoms that have plagued him for months, and that we know in our heart of hearts, signal a recurrence of cancer, although the tests won't confirm it for several more days, I pressed up against him on the couch and whispered against his neck, "This may be the most troublesome time of our lives, but I'm so happy." This awareness of joy, though it's been growing for several years now, has recently expanded in response to my own failing health. A few weeks ago, pondering the possibility that I might die at any moment, I posed myself a new question. If I died at this very moment, would I die happy? And the answer burst out without hesitation, yes. Since then, in spite of my fears, I've felt a new contentment. What more could I ever ask than to give an unequivocal response to such a question? His silence persisted. Scared, I asked him after a few moments, thinking of the doctor's appointment that morning, the CAT scan scheduled for later in the week. Head resting on the back of the couch, eyes closed, he nodded. More silence. Finally, I said, "George, you know how I love words. I need words." And now, words. You will love me. Behind his glasses, his eyes have the startled look I associate incongruously with the moment of orgasm. Yes, I tell him, alert, icy all over. I can safely promise you that. I will always love you. "You asked the other day whether my illness could be AIDS," he said unevenly. "I'm pretty sure it isn't, because I had the test for HIV some time ago, after I had an affair for a couple of years with another woman." The sensation is absolutely nonverbal, but everybody knows it even without words. The stunned breathlessness that follows a jab to the solar plexus. What will astonish me in the days to come is that this sensation can sustain itself long after one would expect to be dead of asphyxiation. I have often wished myself dead. If it were possible to die of grief, I would die at this moment. But it's not, and I don't. A couple of years. A couple of years. This was no fit of passion. No passing fancy, but a sustained commitment. He loved her, loves her still. Their relationship, until he broke it off, for reasons having little to do with me, was a kind of marriage, he says. Time after time after time he went to her, deliberately, telling whatever lies he needed to free himself from me and the children, and later from his mother when she came for a protracted visit after his father's death, throughout at least a couple of years.
Thank you for reading that, Nancy. It's Nancy Mayer's reading from her new memoir, Ordinary Time. When I started reading this passage, I thought it was going to be about another person who grows more loving and virtuous every day after being struck with catastrophe. And the affair really threw me. Of course, it felt like real life. And I was wondering why you started a spiritual autobiography with a story about your husband's affair.
I think that's where spiritual life really begins, is in the very earthy and often painful realities of our lives. We don't develop a spiritual life and then fit in what happens to us. The spiritual life grows out of crisis, I think. And so I began where I felt that such life develops.
Of course, as a Catholic, you believe in forgiveness. What did you think of forgiving your husband for this affair?
What surprised me was that when I talked with a priest who asked if I could ever do so, I discovered that I already had. Although I'd never had to confront the issue explicitly, I can think all the way back to college with my roommate saying, boy, if some guy ever cheated on me, that'd be the last time he ever saw me. And I said, I don't think I would respond that way. And all those years later, 30 years later, I got put to the test, and I guess in my own eyes, I passed.
Why didn't you respond that way?
I think that relationships in my life, the ones that I want to cling to, are more important than anything else. I was 4 and a half when my father died, and so I never had very much of a relationship with him. But it made for me, you know, keeping the people I loved about the most important thing in the world.
When you hear a confession like this, it kind of casts that whole period of your life into a different light. I mean, throughout those 2 years of the affair, things weren't what you thought they were. Did you find yourself replaying the film of your life from those 2 years and reinterpreting the whole thing?
Yes, over and over and over again. One of the things that haunted me the most, I have asked him time and again, and he doesn't, either can't or won't answer, was, what did I believe? What did you tell me when you were going to her that I believed and I just let you go? That haunts me, that I believed everything he told me all the way along, and he told me all those lies. For some reason, that's more important to me than the actual sexual transgression.
Mm-hmm.
Is the lack of faith between us during that period.
In an earlier essay, you wrote, "Dismayingly few marriages survive the multiple sclerosis test, and why should they?" Did you feel that this was part of the test in a way that well, it's because you have MS that he was cheating on you?
I have long felt amazed that he would even stay. Self-image is a real problem with a chronic progressive disease, and I think, you know, I'm a horrible failing cripple, and why doesn't he go get a good, healthy woman? So I think I did justify his action in those terms, and he justified it to himself also. That's one of the things he tells me, is that part of the reason he did this was because of my MS. And yet he didn't leave. It was as though if he had someplace to retreat to from it for a while, he was willing to come back.
Your husband has cancer.
He does, yes.
So he's in the position now of needing care himself. Do you think...
He is, although at the moment we're enjoying a truly miraculous remission.
Good.
And so he has gone back to being my caregiver. With no difficulty. He's feeling physically strong and able. But, of course, we live under that shadow knowing that at some point he will not be able to continue doing this. And I mind terribly the fact that I will not be able to give him any physical care at all. I really can scarcely move. And I have to work on myself, and he helps me in this, to remember that there are other kinds of care than physical. And I hope to God that I'll be available for those. I have been, and I hope I still have the courage to do it when I have to.
Do you ever feel like you're living out some kind of story of Job, you know? that you've just been hit with too much?
Yes, I do. I sometimes think, you know, it's really not very fair to give the family that has MS in it the melanoma too. And I have a little passage in Ordinary Time where I talk about what I would do if I were God. I wouldn't do this sort of thing. But there are all kinds of terrible things that I would do, so it's just as well I'm not God. I will just go on being Nancy, and to be serious now, I've been facetious, but to be serious, I do not at all see these as the hand of God, punishment or anything like that. I see what's happened to us as random happenings. Perhaps like winning the lottery, only nowhere near as much fun. In other words, I don't believe in a fair universe at all.
Right after you found out about your affair, your husband was sick and would really need your comfort and support. And did you feel like, well, yeah, I'm going to give that to you now after what you did to me?
No, but I did think about giving it to Sandra, his ex-lover. I did think to myself, well, how come she got the sex and I get the death? We'll see how good she is at the bedside. You know, I had those cynical feelings. But in fact, no, I was just so grateful, Terry, to have him for as long as I could keep him, that I really didn't feel that way. I just wanted him to stay. He was dying of cancer, and he could do anything as far as I was concerned if he just would stay. And he has for a couple of years now. All sweet borrowed time. I'm grateful for that.
My guest is Nancy Mares. Her new memoir is called Ordinary Time. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Nancy Mares. I believe you were in your 20s when you converted to Catholicism.
In my 30s.
In your 30s. Were friends and family baffled at not only your conversion, but at your religion? I mean, did you find that a lot of people couldn't understand how you could be religious? Did they feel that it kind of went against your intellectualism?
Yes, I certainly think that a lot of people still can say, Nancy Mares is so intelligent. How can she also believe this mumbo-jumbo? In fact, I just had a letter from my step-grandmother asking precisely that question, or rather saying with some relief, I'm so glad that I've read your book now and understand that you don't believe all that mumbo-jumbo. Mine is a very intellectualized Catholicism, I think, in that I do think about it all the time. I don't just mindlessly follow it along.
You were brought up a Congregationalist. Why did you convert to Catholicism?
Well, I can't think of anything more different from Congregationalism, so perhaps we could put it down to some sort of rebellion. I don't think so, though. I think a lot had to do with my life experiences, and I talk in the book about both the aesthetic ones. I studied a lot of art and music and literature, in which Catholicism has had a great hand. And also, I became increasingly involved in social justice issues, and the community that I'm affiliated with in Tucson, we are all deeply involved in that. And so I was sort of called into that community by their commitment to sanctuary, work with Central American refugees, and other similar issues. We do a lot of work with the homeless.
Once when you were in church and you were feeling very bad physically, you prayed to God and you said, Dear God, please heal me. And then you heard a voice.
I did, although it's not like hearing a voice from the outside. These words simply formed in my consciousness. But I am. That was the response to my prayer to be healed.
As in, but I am healing you?
But I am healing you, yes. And so, as I say in the book, I've been stuck ever since with trying to plumb that prayer and its response. How someone as devastated by a neurological degenerative disease can be being healed, maybe not even in spite of that, but in part through that experience. That's a great puzzle to me.
In your writing over the years, you've been very honest about your suicidal depressions, your multiple sclerosis, and agoraphobia. And you know, you've written about this in detail. You also once wrote a piece on the literature of personal disaster. Do you see your writing as falling into that category?
Yes. The piece that I wrote about this said, you know, that I call it literature of personal disaster, only half facetiously. So I'm a little having my tongue in my cheek when I use it. But I do find that a large number of books are published out of people's experience of pain, sorrow, suffering. And the surprising thing about that is that those are certainly qualities subject to enormous sentimentality and even bathos. But a surprising number of these books are really awfully good as books, as pieces of literature.
What do you think separates the really good literature about personal suffering from the, I don't know, more voyeuristic or sentimental books of its kind?
For me, it has a lot to do with language and the capacity to use language in ways that distinguish one's experience from other people's, so that you get a kind of combination going of identification. The reader can identify because all readers have sorrows and pains of their own. And yet the reader is excited by the very individuality of the voice talking about these common experiences. So that someone like, I use Mae Sarton as an example in that essay that you refer to. One doesn't read Mae in order to hear an 80-year-old woman complain. One reads Mae because she creates a wonderful atmosphere. And it happens that that atmosphere is now being created by a suffering 80-year-old woman.
Do you read a lot of books about people's personal suffering?
I read a lot of books about all kinds of things, and for that reason, and the fact that I don't have much time, generally my reading of books about personal suffering is confined to professional activities. That is, I'm about to review a book for the Washington Post that deals with a woman's husband's death. And I'm sure that they got in touch with me because I've developed a kind of expertise in these matters.
Yeah, the queen of personal suffering.
Right. The connoisseur of catastrophe, I think I've called myself. Sometimes I would like, of course, to shake that off and free myself of it. And in fact, I review off and on for the New York Times, for instance, and they are good about not typing me narrowly, but about giving me a range of books to look at.
I think that pop culture has, in a way, become obsessed with suffering. You know, like the movie of the week is always about somebody's cancer or miscarriage or, you know, the murder of their teenage daughter or something. And, you know, I think a lot of the talk shows are obsessed with it also. And
Horribly.
Yeah. And is it snobbish of me to say, well, I really enjoy the really good, well-written literature on the subject, but a lot of this stuff just strikes me as cheap and voyeuristic, and why are we so obsessed with it? What are your thoughts about why our culture is so obsessed with it, not just the best of its kind, but the real cheap stuff, too?
And in fact, I think they prefer the real cheap stuff because it tends to be cast into cliches.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's sort of formulaic. You don't have to have a direct experience with a cliche. It's a formula that everybody has sort of generally agreed on, but you don't have to really apply it deeply to your own life.
You won't be challenged in any way. It won't contradict what you think you're supposed to feel.
That's right. That's right. And so I would suggest to you that such things as those television movies and those talk shows are, in fact, a means for people to distance themselves from suffering, to pretend that it's really not so bad, that it can be, this is one I really hate, if you work hard enough, you can do anything you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could work from now till doomsday, and I will never stand and walk again. And I want to. Oh, I can't tell you, Terry, how I want to get up and walk. And that's a terrible thing to do to people, to give them that message. But that's one of the cliches. And as long as you can stand up and walk, you can mow that cliche, and it will seem to keep my disaster at a distance from you. If this happened to me, you can say, I would want to walk so badly I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that actually those things are doing a real injustice to people with disabilities and to the general population in making them not experience genuine human suffering and loss, and discovering the dimensions of those experiences that are transcendent.
How is your health now?
My general health isn't bad at all, but I get weaker and weaker and weaker, so that I'm definitely looking at a time when I really can't move or perhaps even feed myself. One of my great concerns, of course, has been whether I could touch the keyboard and continue to write.
Right.
And that has been resolved by a gift from an anonymous donor of software that will enable me to speak my words and have them pop up on the computer screen.
That's great.
Voice-activated software.
That's great.
So I'm hoping that I can continue to write at least for a while longer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm so glad I had the chance. Thank you.
Nancy Mayer's new memoir is called Ordinary Time. This was a rebroadcast of an interview that was preempted on many stations last week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.